From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening to this special edition for the 2025 Wilmington City Council election. This year, there are three open seats on council, and we have eight candidates, including six challengers and two incumbents. We also have three candidates for mayor, including our incumbent mayor. While the city council race is technically nonpartisan, the local Democratic and Republican parties do play a role in supporting candidates. And for city council, we have three Republican candidates, one unaffiliated candidate, and four Democratic candidates, although the county Democratic Party implemented a straw poll to narrow its support to just three of those candidates and one of the two Democrats running for mayor. And we'll have information on all of that on our show page. On today's show, we're interviewing Democratic challenger Jonathan Barfield Jr., who is running for mayor. Barfield served four terms as a New Hanover County Commissioner, including several years as chairman before narrowly losing a re-election bid last year. We'll ask him a host of questions drawn from listeners and readers and our community agenda program. We'll also ask what he would do with the office of mayor above and beyond what a city council member could do. All right, Jonathan Barfield, candidate for mayor of Wilmington. Thank you very much for your time today.
Glad to be here with you, Ben.
Okay, so most people in this region will know of you after your years of service on the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners. But just in case, we have some recent arrivals here. Tell people a little bit about yourself.
You know, I grew up here in Wilmington. I moved here when I was a year old. My father's from here. My dad met my mom in Ohio when his brother was stationed in the Air Force there. And I tell folks I got here as quick as I could. My siblings were all born here. But this is where I was raised and grew up, a product of the school system here. Graduated from New England High School back in 1984. I've been around politics for a long time. My father was the first African-American elected to the Board of County Commissioners in 1980. So in 79, you know, I was a part of this process, watching him, you know, mount a campaign, you know, being around people like Dorothy Johnson and Luther Jordan, being around people like Tony Pate, who was on the city council, and Catherine Moore, being around Joe McQueen, who was our first African-American sheriff. I kind of grew up in this whole political sphere of watching things happen and watching grassroots organizations, you know, make things happen. My wife and I, Laura, have been married for 37 years next month. I was in the Navy back in the early, mid-80s, and got fortunate enough to be stationed in Key West, Florida, where I met my wife. She's from Key West, and we've raised four daughters. Now we have two grandsons, which is the coolest thing, to have these two little boys. One is two, one will be two in October, to be able to pour into. I've enjoyed public service. Again, enlisting in the Navy at 17, started my public service, you know, journey, and then getting elected to the Board of County Commissioners in 2008, serving 16 years. I was fortunate to be chair of the board on four separate occasions, vice chair on three separate occasions. And it's kind of cool hanging out with my pop. He's just turned 80 in April, and I'm named after him, you know. So when I ran the first time, people thought he was running for office again. So I got votes on name recognition alone, which was, I didn't care how I got votes as long as I got them. But, you know, to be around him and to share this legacy with him is really cool for me.
So this is technically a nonpartisan race for mayor and city council, but we're asking all the candidates if they're affiliated with a party, which party and why.
You know, I've been a Democrat since I registered the first time. But as I tell folks, you know, your job as an elected official is not about representing Democrats, Republicans, black, white, rich or poor. Your job is to represent all the citizens, you know, all your constituents, and make sure that everyone's getting equal access to your thoughts and opinions, but also your consideration. And so for me, it's always been about what I think is the right thing to do, as opposed to the partisan or political thing to do in every situation. And that's how I govern myself. The thing my dad shared with me when I first got elected, he said, son, the thing about you that I love is that you come to the table with no agenda other than to do the right thing. And that's what I've done, you know, as a county commissioner for 16 years.
All right. Well, let's get into some of the policy questions we've got here. Top of mind for a lot of people we talk to in the community is affordable housing. I know the county has dealt with this for many years. The city has been dealing with it for many years. Where would you like to see the city of Wilmington take this issue? Are there things you think they're doing they should, you know, double down on, change course? How do you see this issue?
You know, I've been a part of the housing affordability conversation for a long time. The early 2000s, I actually chaired the Affordable Housing Coalition, which has a new name now in our community, But I've been in it prior to me getting into politics, as it's been a passion of mine to make sure that people that work here can also afford to live here. And I was happy when we, as a county commission, voted to invest $15 million over 5 years, $3 million a year in housing affordability, recognizing that counties do not get any community development block grant money as cities do to invest. The county used to get those resources. When my dad was on the board, I think they helped build quite a few new homes in Reichsboro that were pretty much storm damaged. But counties don't get those resources anymore. So taking real money and investing. We also invested several million dollars from our federal dollars into the Starway Village project to help them with gap funding. I think you've got to bring resources to the table, financial resources, number one, not just loans and hot programs, but bring, you know, financial resources and provide the right incentives for developers to build more affordable units. I would much rather see people buy homes as opposed to rent. You know, owning a home is where you build generational wealth. When you're paying rent, you're just paying someone else's mortgage. But if you can buy a home and have that affordable for you, you can pass that on to your grandchildren and have that wealth for your family. As so many families, that was the stockpile of their wealth, you know, creation. In some cases, it wasn't a lot, but it was a home that you had that was grandmama's home that was passed down in the family. At the same time, working with developers that are getting these low-income tax credits to where they're going to provide rents that are 30, 60, 80% of the area median income is definitely important so that those folks can also have a place to live. And our senior population is struggling. We have very few senior apartment complexes, and I know this because my mom's a senior. We're trying to find her place, and she ended up getting a decent place. But most of these places have at least a year waiting list for the affordable units. And so that's a long time when seniors are trying to figure out what do I do and got limited fixed income based on Social Security and a small retirement, you know, how do I make ends meet, so to speak. And so I would like the city, you know, to bring more money to bear, find ways to get creative when it comes to the right incentives for developers, because it takes money to offset the cost of development to make these things work and make it financially viable for them to help us with our mission of providing affordable housing.
So, related issue, at least this is how we see it in our newsroom. We look at homelessness as sort of part of a Venn diagram of housing and mental health and substance use. And I don't think anyone's found a silver bullet for this, but I'm curious how you think the city of Wilmington should approach the homelessness issue, or if you think the city should have a role in it.
You know, I've said for a long time, but for the grace of God, there go I. And I have seen people who lived in landfall lose it all. I've seen people that were wealthy take their lives because their financial resources went away. They made one mistake or a calamity of things happened and they didn't see any way out. So instead of being homeless on the street, they decided to take their lives. Things can happen to anyone, no matter what your pedigree is. And it's important that, you know, we all have compassion and empathy for folks in situations because it could be you tomorrow. You know, when you have companies that shut down, a natural disaster happens. You know, you got folks in Western North Carolina became homeless in an instant when the last storm came through. You know, what do you do in those situations when there are things that happen beyond your control? And so finding ways to bring to bear resources that can help people is what's important to me. Empowering financially, you know, day shelters, you know, increasing capacity, you know, with the Salvation Army, with the Good Shepherd, and with others that are coming online to help them provide those rooms and whatnot. You know, during COVID, the county used some of our federal dollars to provide hotel rooms for the homeless. Didn't want COVID to spread within those encampments. And so, you know, what better way than to provide decent housing for someone at a hotel for a long period of time? And, you know, supporting efforts like Eden Village, you know, I think the county, we gave $250,000 initially to help them with their water and sewer infrastructure. To see how that has come out is just truly phenomenal. And, you know, it's heartwarming. But, you know, recognizing that those are our neighbors. Some of those people are our friends. As my dad would always say, son, you don't kick a man when he's down. And because that could be you tomorrow. And I truly believe that, you know, that it could happen to anyone at any given point in time. I've seen those things happen. I've gone to, you know, been a part of Bible studies with folks that you thought had it going on that aren't here anymore because of that one financial calamity.
What do you make of pressure from some folks to take a more law and order approach to this?
Criminalizing homelessness is the wrong approach. Understand, you know, the businesses downtown in particular are concerned about people loitering and being around that may discourage people from coming into their places of business. I understand that. But moving people from one corner to another, that's not solving the problem. You got to solve the problem. Find the resources that will solve the problem so you're not pushing people from one part of your city to another to make this one group over here happy, but now someone else is not happy because people have moved. Provide resources, provide, day shelters and night shelters. And I'm thankful that, the county supported building the healing place, which has been a shelter for some of the unsheltered during storms and cold weather and whatnot, providing those that they had extra space there, for individuals. Seeing our churches come together, and having warming shelters and now cooling shelters, on these hot days, it takes the community itself stepping up as well. But there's a place for local government to be a part of that. And then for me, criminalizing homelessness, as I voted against the county's ordinance a couple of years ago, I didn't realize that it needed a unanimous vote to make it stick the first time. And so we brought it back. And when it came back, it didn't pass. And then later, with different people on the board, it did pass. But we're seeing the city trying to take the same approach, which I think is the wrong step.
I want to ask about how you would approach development from the city of Wilmington's mayor's desk. There's not a lot of buildable land left in the city, but there's still probably some contentious projects on the horizon. Every time, especially we see like a larger multifamily or mixed-use development, we see at least some pushback from neighbors, usually. On the other hand, I think it's unavoidable. The city's growing. People are moving here. And without more housing units, we are going to continue to see supply and demand, right? So increasing rents. How would you approach trying to find that balance between, allowing development and sort of recognizing that some people feel like the pace of development is maybe out of whack or out of alignment?
Now, the first thing that comes to my mind is the fact that no matter where you live, at one point in time, there were trees on that property. And some developer came in and developed so you could live where you're living. So none of us are guilt-free when it comes to development because people are living in houses. And houses have been built by developers who came in and tore down trees to put those homes there. Whether it happened in your lifetime or whether you bought an older home that happens, some of the time period, the fact of the matter is when I grew up here, you had a lot of two-lane roads coming in and you didn't have the traffic that we have. As I often ask folks when I'm speaking in large groups for a show of hands of how many folks are not from here. And most people raise their hand. I say, well, you're the problem. When I grew up here, we didn't have a traffic problem until you got here. We didn't have this problem until you got here. And recognizing that, people talk about, well, we got to protect our green space. I explain to folks that for me, our green space is Greenfield Lake, Early Gardens, Longleaf Park, Ogden Park, Veterans Park. Those are public spaces. The other space, land, belongs to someone. That's their property, and you have private property rights that protect you and give you the ability to do certain things by right with your property. So you can't go in and tell other people what they can't do if it meets the guidelines of the law. I know the developers are trying to get as much density as possible when it comes to building. I love where I live. I live in an R15 community. Never want to be in an HOA, someone telling me what to do, bring my trash can out, put it out at a certain time, bring it back in a certain time. But I've got plenty of space between me and my neighbor. I love it. I don't want to be in a neighborhood where people are looking at what I'm cooking on the grill and shaking my hand at the same time. But that worked for some people. And recognizing that with the housing needs study that we did a few years ago, I think we were 25,000 plus built units behind between rentals and stick-built homes. But we don't have enough land to accomplish that. And so the building is going to have to take place in Brunswick and Columbus County and Pender counties to help accommodate the needs that are here for our community when it comes to working. And so you're seeing Columbus County now, I was a part of an affordable housing conversation with new head of Pender, Brunswick, and Columbus County a couple of years ago with this group called the NC Leadership Forum, which I'm on their board now. And we had a conversation with these four counties about housing affordability. In Columbus County, the manager said, we are a low-wealth, poor county and trying to figure stuff out when it comes to water and sewer. But now you're seeing an explosion there on the southern end of the county, close to South Carolina, but also on the northern end, closer to Brunswick County, as developers are putting pressure on but they got to get the water and sewer infrastructure in place because people are buying homes in those places to come work here in Wilmington because this is where the jobs are. This is where the entertainment center is. You know, you don't have a 1,500-seat auditorium in Columbus County like the Wilson Center or in Brunswick County, but you don't have those kind of major Broadway plays coming in those places, so they're coming here for those things. And so finding ways to balance that is definitely going to be a challenge as developers are trying to find as much land as they can, and land prices are continuing to go up. When I first started in real estate in the late 90s, it was amazing. One developer would build the same house in New Hanover County and in Brunswick County, but the house in Brunswick County would be $20,000+ less for the same exact house because the cost of land acquisition and other infrastructure was different. At the same time, I've got a friend that bought a brand new home in Brunswick County, this beautiful neighborhood, but they're all on septic. And he can't put any trees in his backyard because the septic lines are running. I'm thinking, I would never pay that much money for a home that has a septic tank, you know. But they don't have water and sewer infrastructure in large parts of Brunswick County, so they're trying to deal with that piece as well. The answer for me is to take it slow. I'm thankful that the NCDOT is finally going to bring overpasses into the MLK Parkway. What should have happened when it was initially built to have a true parkway. They'll have flyovers at MLK and Kerr and College Road and Market Street and Military Cutoff so the traffic can flow a bit freer. I'm not sure how it's going to work with this roundabout on River Road and Independence because there's a lot of traffic there. But, you know, I guess trying to find ways to make traffic flow is definitely going to be important as we have more people coming here.
So just a quick follow-up on that. One place it's been suggested that we could put more density would be in Wilmington's urban core, the Central Business District. So we have some taller buildings in town. We've got the PBD building, we've got the Murchison building. Whatever happens at Project Grace could be, by local standards, a skyscraper. I remember when the county first rolled out that project, we were talking about Wilmington's first skyscraper. Do you think Wilmington's ready for that kind of density downtown?
To me, it has to happen if you truly want a downtown grocery store, a viable one. When you go to Charlotte, you see Harris Teeter's right downtown, you know. It's not your traditional Harris Teeter where you've got a parking lot, you know. Some of these places have underground parking decks that you can park underneath and then go into the stores, as in Washington, D.C. But, you know, when you have those dense urban areas, you've got to have those resources that are there. And seeing more rooftops downtown is developing that market for a grocery store to come downtown. I was disappointed that the Northside Food Co-op or grocery store has been somewhat scrapped because I think there's a need for both of those. You know, where I live, I could walk less than a half a mile to an Aldi. I could go right across the street to a Food Lion, a little further down, walking to a Publix. You know, I live in a food oasis as opposed to a food desert. But I lived on McCray Street when I first moved back home, a home that my dad built. And, you know, I'm 20, 21, 22 years old. I didn't realize I was in a food desert, but I was. I had to drive a long way to get food, but I had never heard the term food desert, but I lived in that house for 4 years. And recognizing that we had zero pharmacies anywhere nearby, zero fast food restaurants nearby, as well as grocery stores. And so for me, the grocery store piece is important as we develop more rooftops downtown.
So last thing about sort of land use would be green space. And you touched on this already, but we do hear a lot of concerns from folks about both, you know, what you were talking about. There used to be a lot more open space covered with trees, but also sort of Wilmington's tree canopy in general. And that, I mean, that takes money and effort and people power. So is that something you think the city should be investing in?
Definitely. If you come to my yard, you see trees everywhere. You know, my backyard, I love nature. I love, feeding the birds and seeing squirrels in my backyard and seeing the occasional opossum and turtles and rabbits in my neighborhood that's in the city. Making sure that I'm cultivating the right, you know, nature-esque feel for the animals that are a part of my neighborhood. Finding ways to protect the tree canopy, I think, is important because trees help mitigate pollution, you know, by, you know, bringing in the old stuff and putting back in the atmosphere oxygen, which is what we all need to breathe, as well as, you know, filtering out some of the contaminants in the soil when it comes to them drinking the water and whatnot. So finding ways to, you know, protect the environment. You know, we talk a lot about and try to encourage what I call low-impact development techniques, where the developer can have a lesser impact on the environment. The number one community that comes to my mind is Demarest Village and Demarest Landing off of Pimlico Sound. Well, that developer was very thoughtful when he came in with smaller streets, you know, having underground cisterns, you know, for water runoff so that you can use reuse that water to water your yard as opposed to, you know, tapping into CFPUH water. You know, finding ways to create those kind of atmospheres, I think, will definitely help our environment.
I want to pivot to economic development.
Mm-hmm.
So over the years, the city and the county have been part of a number of incentive programs like PBD or Live Oak. And then there's also been, for the city, working through, you know, a couple of economic development partners, programs where they're hoping to bring, you know, business owners and leaders to Wilmington and kind of sell them on the region as like, this is a good place to start up a business, or this is a good place to move and grow your business. So where would you like to see the city's efforts go in terms of that kind of economic development?
I think for the last while, we've been in a good place. You know, the county has participated in just about every incentive that the city's been a part of, because, of course, everyone lives in the county. And so the first one I think I was a part of, you know, I was at the groundbreaking for Live Oak Bank for the initial building and our investment there, and to see with their campus now, you know, 5-6 buildings, you know, providing jobs for UNCW grads, many are making over 6 figures there. Being there with Castle Branch as we did state and local incentives for them when they built their additional building and brought on an additional 400 jobs in our community, you know, paying $45,000 plus a year. You know, the National Gypsum coming back, and the county and the city both at the table to provide incentives there. And incentives really are just a tax rebate. You know, they've got to come in and produce X number of jobs, bring in a certain amount of equipment and make certain investments before they get any rebate back. For me, it's like taking a coupon to Belk and saying, I want to buy this suit or this dress, and handing that coupon in, and you're getting a discount basically. But at the same time, you're bringing in jobs that are paying considerable wages and where people can buy homes and cars and eat in restaurants and help that our whole economy flourish. So finding the right companies. You know, when I first got elected in 08, the big conversation was stop Titan. You know, the community was very clear. We don't want any more smokestacks coming to our community. Wilmington Industrial Development changed the name to Wilmington Business Development and recognizing that the industrial age in our community had passed. And it's time to recruit green jobs here, you know, but jobs that pay a livable wage. As I was talking with the individuals with Amazon coming here with their new facility, you know, as a county had partnered with someone with Pender County with the Pender Commerce Park, as some of that land where Amazon's building is going to sit is actually sitting in New Hanover County. And they were saying, we're going to be paying $15 an hour. I'm like, you know, who's going to drive that far out for $15 an hour? You need to rethink your pay structure, number one. I want companies to come in that will pay a livable wage where people can actually live and take care of their families, offer the resources as opposed to, you know, struggling from day to day. Even the county's minimum wage is now, I think, $18 or $19 an hour, which, as I tell folks, if you're a single individual at that pay rate, you couldn't barely afford to rent an apartment here, much less buy a home in our community.
Definitely not buy a home after the given the way the market has been going. So I want to ask you about this. You know, over the last 20 years, 22 or 23 years, I've personally watched Wilmington grow a lot. There's been a lot of economic success, a lot of affluence come to this region. That hasn't been the story equally across Wilmington. There is a pretty palpable sense of haves and have-nots. There's a lot of economic disparity. And in Wilmington, that looks like racial disparity a lot of the times. So do you think the city of Wilmington has a role in addressing that kind of inequality? And if so, where do you think the city could take action?
I think you have that challenge in every city in our country and throughout the world. You will always have some that have some and some have more than others. This book I like to read says that the poor will always be with you. And it's been true from the time when Jesus walked on the earth until now. And so finding ways to level the playing field, whether it be, you know, resources that the counties can employ, deploy, like Department of Social Services provides great resources. Our health department with the SNAP program, you know, with the WIC program, provides, you know, resources for those moms that may be struggling that can provide, you know, food and nutrition for their baby and for themselves when they're, you know, having young kids. You know, with the SNAP program, providing, you know, resources there for some folks that find themselves needing some extra help when it comes to being able to take care of themselves and feed themselves. Nourish and See is another organization that stepped in to make sure that our kids don't go to bed hungry when they're getting out of school. At the same time, again, from the county standpoint, the city standpoint, recruiting industry here that will pay a livable wage so that you don't have folks dropping below the poverty line, so that you have families that are able to take care of themselves financially, so you have people that can afford to pay rents and whatnot. That's my goal, to not have anyone have to depend on any system other than having a great job or opportunity to provide for themselves based on companies that are coming here paying wages that they can support themselves and live and thrive.
So I want to ask about public safety. So the Wilmington Police Department, the Wilmington Fire Department, I'm curious, for both of those departments, there are sort of longstanding issues with recruiting and retaining. This is not a novel issue to Wilmington. I think a lot of places are dealing with this. But how would you like to see the city, you know, try and maintain like a good culture, good esprit de corps in those departments and keep, you know, veteran officers and firefighters from leaving?
Number one, you got to pay your people. You have to show them the love. You know, we came to the county with our first responders a couple of years ago. We recognized the need to retain and keep people in place. And so we authorized our county manager to give a tremendous increase financially to those departments first, our sheriff's department and our first responders, our fire department, the folks who work in 911 that take the biggest hits to make sure that number one feel valued. You know, you can show value by what you're paying folks, number one. You can show value to individuals by the incentives that you offer, the intangibles, the benefits that come with the total package as well, having extra days off, having differential pay. You can show love and appreciation in a whole host of ways. But it starts there. You know, it starts with the city recognizing that, you know, these first responders are putting their lives on the line every day to make sure that our community is safe. Those are the folks, as well as your teachers, that need to have that significant pay bump to be able to take care of themselves. I'm a realtor, you know. I was showing property in Brunswick County the other day, and I saw a New York County Sheriff's deputy car parked in a neighborhood in Mallory Creek. I'm thinking, you know, this is where the housing affordability is for these individuals, you know. But again, you know, as I talk with the benevolence group, you know, making sure that it's not just the money piece, but it needs to be increased because I think there's some of the lowest paid in our region. And from the county standpoint, we recognize that we were losing people to other departments for a small amount of money. You know, we had a gentleman working in our Veteran Services Department that was making considerably less than he should have been making and about to leave our community to go to Wake County, and sat down with the HR director and said, listen, you need to look at this whole situation and recognize we were underpaying and made some adjustments right then and there on the spot. So, again, I think starting with the paying classification study, you know, sometimes you don't need to do a study. You already know the answer. But if you need to do that from a city standpoint, do it and then make the adjustments necessary to pay those people what they're worth.
When it comes to the police department, there's a new police chief will be announced later this month, I believe. And I'm curious if you have thoughts on, let's call it the policing style of the Wilmington Police Department. Are you, you know, do you feel happy with the way WPD has been sort of serving the city? Are there changes that you'd like to see there?
You know, I think the community policing model, for me, worked. My family, we're actually going to their family night out event at the Point the other night until the monsoon came in and kind of postponed that event. But to go out there and kind of fellowship with the members of law enforcement and see all the toys and things that they have as well, and just let them know that the community, it's a family night out for families, but also to show the appreciation to the law enforcement as well for the work that they're doing, you know, I think for me it's vitally important.
My last policy question for you is about public transportation, which you have been intimately involved with through WAVE from the county side. And I'm just curious where you think WAVE is at right now and where you would like to see it go, literally and figuratively.
You know, I served on WAVE's board for 13 years. I was disappointed when, with some leadership with the county, we decided to boot everyone off the board, on the board, off the board, and then come in with county staff and a few elected officials. When for years she had citizen input, you know, we recruited people to be a part of that board to give insight. And because some people's ideology didn't agree with public transportation, decided to rein things in, so to speak. When you go to any major metro city in our country, you know, my youngest daughter just moved to Manhattan, New York. And she takes the bus to work. Her car is here in Wilmington. There's no need to have it. It costs too much money in New York to have a car. But she went to UNC Charlotte. When she walked out of her dorm room, the light rail was right there where she could go uptown whenever she wanted to, because it was literally right outside of her dorm door. So we're training students in colleges to embrace public transportation. But here, when you get here, it's like, okay, we're not going to fund it adequately. You know, we need to have bus rapid transit lanes here in our community where buses will zip by, you know, pretty darn quick, have shorter headways, not on just a few routes, but every route where the bus is coming every 20 minutes as opposed to 30 minutes or on the hours it used to be. But also invest more. What people don't know is that, you know, with the way the federal government has public transit set up, the people that drive the bus at WAVE, they don't work for WAVE. They work for a company called First Transit. There are entities that actually manage and are like a union somewhat for the people that drive the bus. And then you have the management side of the house. And so there's a negotiation there. So you're paying this middle management company a good chunk of change as well to do that, where I don't think there's a need for that. And you could take that money and invest it in those employees, number one, but also invest it in buses. The majority of the buses that WAVE gets are really coming from federal grants, a bus costs you about $400,000, maybe a little bit more now. And so trying to get those federal grants to actually buy those. You know, I'm thankful that, you know, WAVE in its foresight, when it built the new operations center, put the natural gas pipeline in there so that many of the buses that are running now are running on natural gas, which is much better for the environment. But again, finding ways to increase the number of buses that are running so you have more frequency, and taking the county and investing more. You know, the county got into this business with WAVE. The county was running its own vans and whatnot for folks that are going to DSS and the health department and having to go here, there, and everywhere. So the county decided to partner with the city and form this authority. And so pretty much offsetting their cost, what they were spending, by now spending it, you know, with WAVE in a joint venture somewhat. So the county, for the most part, for years, was more of a fee-for-service kind of partner, as opposed to the city stepping in and actually putting in real dollars to help it run. And when WAVE find themselves backed up financially, it would be the city that would come in and actually bail them out with the financial loan. And we toyed with raising rates and whatnot, but that becomes unaffordable for those, not choice riders, but folks that have to ride, you know, the bus. And so finding that balance is important. But the investment in public transportation, in my opinion, is a good investment. That same daughter is now in Greece, you know, working from there for a little while. And these other places, you see a robust public transportation system.
I spent almost a decade in New York, and I don't know how I would have been able to live without public transportation. It just wouldn't have worked. I do want to ask, because you might have some insight into this. I feel like there's also a cultural aspect here where Wilmington just feels like a car city. And even people who live on bus lines, and it might even be more convenient and cheaper for them to take the bus, don't take the bus. Do you feel like there's some, I don't know if it's outreach or engagement or education that could be done to, you know, let people know that, hey, this is actually like an option for getting around town?
Again, if you had shorter headways, that would create more choice riders. But I can't go and wait for the bus to come every hour on the hour. I've got to be to work at 9:15, you know, that just may not work for me. And so it's going to take you an hour to two to go to a transfer station to get on another bus to take you where you got to get to. It's got to be a faster system, a more robust system, a more efficient system to create choice riders. And that's what they're trying to get is choice riders. At the same time, having grown up here, you know, in this community, it's always been this mindset that only poor people ride the bus. But again, when you go to your major metro cities, your business executives ride public transportation.
I rode the bus from my apartment in Chinatown to the financial district. And on my way home, I would be on the bus with some of the wealthiest people from Bear mm-hmm. Stearns and Lehman Brothers, mm-hmm. really nice suits. I was there in my smock and my apron, but yeah, yeah.
But trying to change the thought process in the image has been a challenge for WAVE for a while to change people's mindsets.
So here's my last question for you. In that you are running for mayor and not council. And mayor is, on the one hand, kind of like a council person with a gavel, but there is just something extra about the office. You have a platform. You have certain responsibilities during, you know, emergency situations. But I want to ask, what is it specifically about the mayor's office that you would want to do as above and beyond just the, you know, also important role of a council member?
You know, being chairman of the Board of County Commissioners on 4 separate years, same role, the county commission chair, you know, signed official documents on behalf of the county, was that official spokesperson in many ways. When we came to hurricanes and storms, you're that person leading the EOC and the media front as well. I've been in that role, whether it's chair of the board of commissioners, vice chair of the board of commissioners, I've been in that role, but in a much bigger way. As I share with folks, I've served as a citizen of Wilmington for 16 years, but in a much more comprehensive way, as the county provides much more services and a host of services that are very different. When you get arrested, you don't go to the city jail, you go to the county jail. When you call 911, you call the county's 911, no matter where you live in our community. When you go into the health department, the library, the museum, those are all county functions. When you get your kid immunized, you go to the county's health department. And so we provide the services that everyone needed, as opposed to only a handful. So I've been able to provide a bigger array of services to everyone in the city of Wilmington for 16 years. And so for me, it would be a cinch to step down to the local level, to the municipal level, when I've been at the county level, the most powerful governing body at the local level for 16 years. And again, being chairman of the Board of Commissioners for four separate years has definitely, given me the skill set to do just that, because I'm at a greater position.
Fair enough, yeah. All right, well, anything else that you would want to add, or something we didn't touch on that you want to get to?
I'm excited about this opportunity. There's been a lot of conversation around this straw poll that the Democratic Party did. And I shared this with every media outlet, but no one wants to run my comments. And what I've been sharing is that I met with our party chair before our county convention, and your good friend asked me not to run. And then she told me that the seat belonged to Bill. And so I'm thinking, why would I be a part of a straw poll that's already fixed? When the chair of your party has asked you not to run, then the chair of your party tells you the seat belongs to the incumbent. That bias right there alone influences the outcome. And I've been saying a lot that it's become the Democratic Party of 1898 all over again.
You feel like that's hyperbolic?
When you look at the straw polls that have happened, the only folks that have been eliminated are black men, people that look like me. As I told Jill, I said, there's no way the party's going to support two African-American candidates in this race. I grew up in this thing. Again, my dad was the first black elected to the county commission. And I saw the strike that he went through in 1980. I've been a part of this political thing for a long time and understand this community. And how do you not select your mayor pro tem that served for 8 years? But that's what it is. Back in the old days when African Americans were given the right to vote, you go to vote and you have to count the number of jelly beans in the jar. Somehow folks could never get that number right, so they couldn't vote. But again, for someone to pick and choose what person of color they want to lead, when the party has never done this in the history, but now all of a sudden we got to figure out how do we limit and control. And to tell a 16-year veteran of the county commission, someone who's led at that level, that the seat belongs to an incumbent, it's a people seat. The people get to decide who they want to sit in those seats, not a party chair. And so that's why I chose not to participate. And I recall when I first announced early on, you made a comment that I read, and it kind of stuck in the back of my mind, that Jonathan, I'm going to paraphrase, has ticked off the party elites because he didn't go through the proper steps. So I know that you had conversation with someone early on about Jonathan stepping into a race without going and asking anyone. But as I told Jill, I don't have to ask you for permission to run. When I ran the first time, I wasn't asking anyone for permission to run. I don't have to go to someone and say, can I do this? Because I'm an American. I served in the military. I have served so that people can have the right to go out there and run for office or to protest or to say what they want to say. And so for someone to tell me it belongs to someone else.
I take your point. I would say I had heard that you had frustrated the Democratic Party. I certainly think holding the straw poll before the end of filing period felt like the party was taking on quite a bit of authority over the process, because I feel like after that straw poll, there was still a couple of weeks where someone could have decided, hey, I feel like I should run. And I certainly have heard frustrations that was, overstepping or even anti-democratic. So I take your point there.
It's all of that. As I heard our party chair say, the reason was is that they were hoping that some people would drop out.
Right.
So again, trying to force, and it takes a lot of courage to stand alone. But I've been in those places before as a county commissioner where you're that one lone voice and then you see things turn around. I think about the movie 12 Angry Men, where Henry Fonda's character was that lone voice saying, I don't think he's guilty. And in the end, the other 11 came around and said not guilty. But it takes courage and great intestinal fortitude when you see the winds turning. But you know that this is the wrong thing to do. It's not right on a number of reasons. But again, for someone to try to limit the number of people that look like me in a race, is definitely not part of the ideals that I served in the military for.
I will ask, since you brought it up, do you think that a party that oversteps, or even in the opinions of some people, is acting in a anti-democratic, lowercase d way, do you think that is the same as 1898? Do you feel like that is a valid, I mean, because that was a horrifying genocidal massacre. Do you feel like that's a valid comparison?
For me, it's those things lead up to things. Nazi Germany didn't just happen. There were steps that got it to where it was. 1898 didn't just happen. There were steps that got it to where it was. And when good people sit back and say nothing, bad things happen. And I think there are enough people that voice concerns, but sometimes we go along and get along. Sometimes people just go along with the pack as opposed to thinking for themselves. You know, as an elected official, you got to be able to think for yourself. You know, you can't just be swayed because the red shirts come in and the blue shirts come in without looking at all the facts and the data and make sure that you're making a sound decision. And again, so things in many cases, you know, happen over time. You know, when a person has congestive heart failure, it didn't just start because they ate a burger. You know, it started because other things in their lifestyle led to them not doing X, Y, and Z. They weren't exercising. They were doing this, that, and the other thing. And the next, you know, you have this big, bad thing happening. So, again, there's steps to things that cause downfalls in societies and communities. And if you're not careful and folks go along with all those steps, you're complicit in the process.
So do you feel like the Democratic Party's support of some candidates over others, do you think that'll impact the race?
I don't plan on impacting my race. You know, I'm in this thing to win it. I would not have filed if I didn't think I could win this race, looking at the totality of a county commission race where you're looking at 60,000 votes versus 12 or 15,000 in a mayoral race. You know, so it's a whole different scope at the county level. And so does using the skill sets that I've, you know, gained at that level. You know, I lost my last race by 249 votes. There were so many missiles coming at me in that race, you know, from the Tide Turners group and others, you know, that I can't be upset or mad about the loss. For me, as I said in my farewell speech, all I can do is trust God in every step of the way and know that I've not been told my assignment is over yet. And so I've got to trust God in this process.
All right. Well, anything else?
I'm good.
Thank you very much for your time today. Jonathan Barfield Jr., candidate for mayor of the city of Wilmington. Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here.
That was our interview with Democratic challenger Jonathan Barfield, who is running for mayor of Wilmington. And just a note here, we reached out to Jill Hopman, chairwoman of the New Hanover County Democratic Party, who disputed Barfield's account of their conversation. She issued a statement that read, in part, quote, "Since 2023, the NHCDP has used a transparent and inclusive endorsement process for municipal elections, including a straw poll where hundreds of our members decide which candidates have the strongest party support." You can find the full statement and other coverage of the straw poll on our show page. All right, I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening to this special edition of The Newsroom. And check out our other candidate interviews at whqr.org or wherever you get The Newsroom as a podcast.